Chapter 31. Dedicating the Earthly Tabernacle. Remember that a temple but foreshadows the idea of God, the, quote, house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens, end quote, while a silent, grand man or woman, healing sickness and destroying sin, builds that which reaches heaven. Mary Baker Eddy, 1906. All the field thrilled to the notice, Stephen A. Chase wrote on the 2nd of June, Miscellany, page 27. The Boston Globe wrote it up this way, quote, please do not send us any more money. We have enough, end quote. Briefly, that is the notice which Stephen A. Chase, treasurer of the building fund of the new Christian Science Temple, sent forth when they erected the first church in Boston 12 years ago. It was found necessary to issue a similar notice. If you ask a Christian Scientist how they do it, the reply will be in the form of a quotation from Science and Health, page 494. Quote, divine love always has met and always will meet every human need, end quote. By early June, all the Boston newspapers were reporting on the size, beauty, and architectural details of the beautiful new Mother Church extension, as well as all of the activities and pending activities connected therewith. The Boston Post said, never before has the city been more frequented by members of the title aristocracy of the old world than it is now. From all the centers of Europe, there are streaming into town lords and ladies who come to attend the dedication of the new church for Christian Scientists. A few days later, the Boston Transcript reported, special trains and extra sections of trains are due to arrive in Boston tonight, bearing the first installments of the crowds of Christian Scientists from the central and western sections of this country. Those from abroad and from the far west, to a large degree, are already in Boston. Extensive newspaper coverage was given to the dedication of the Mother Church extension. The reporter from the Boston Herald expressed a feeling and a truth, which was felt by many. There have been church ceremonies that appealed more to the eye, but the impressiveness of this lay in its very simplicity. Its grandeur sprang from the complete unanimity of thought and of purpose. There was something emanating from the thousands who worshipped under the dome of the great edifice, whose formal opening they had gathered to observe, that appealed to and fired the imagination. A comparatively new religion, launching upon a new era, assuming an altogether different status before the world. The reports from Boston were reprinted and repeated in every town and hamlet in the United States and in cities all over the world. Even scoffers were impressed, as this article from the Norfolk, Nebraska Tribune implies. To those who seem to see no good in Christian Science, it must stagger their faith, not a little, to read the account of the dedication of the vast temple located in the heart of the city of Boston, the supposed fountain of knowledge and seat of learning of America, the spectacle of 30,000 people assembling to gain admission to the temple shows an enthusiasm for Christian Science seldom witnessed anywhere in the world on any occasion. And this occurred in staid old Boston, and the fact was heralded in flaming headlines in the leading newspapers of the world. According to the dispatches, that assembly was not a gathering of, quote, the vulgar throng, end quote. The intelligence and wisdom of the country were there. There certainly must be something more than a fad in Christian Science, which was placed upon a far higher pedestal by that demonstration than it ever occupied before. The world saw the architectural splendor and the thousands who came to witness the dedication of this marvel. But the heart and soul of the occasion was the leader's message, quote, "Choose ye," end quote. Miscellany, page 3. The scripture reads, quote, "He that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me," end quote. On this basis, how many are following the way-shower? We follow truth only as we follow truly, meekly, patiently, spiritually, blessing saint and sinner with the leaven of divine love, which woman has put into Christendom and medicine. It will be found that instead of opposing, such an individual subserves the interests of both medical faculty and Christianity, and they thrive together, learning that mind power is goodwill towards men. The modest edifice of the Mother Church of Christ Scientist began with the cross. Its crowning ultimate rises to a mental monument, a superstructure high above the work of men's hands, even the outcome of their hearts. Her words were for a future generation. The Christian Scientists in 1906 were rejoicing in the structure, which was, quote, "the work of men's hands," end quote, which the Boston Post called, quote, "a marvel of architectural beauty," end quote, and which was receiving the world's acclaim. The Post also remarked about its, quote, "enormous size," end quote, stating, quote, "but one church in the country exceeds it in seating capacity," end quote. Notwithstanding this fact, it was necessary to hold a second session to accommodate all the members who were there to attend the annual meeting on Tuesday, June 12th. On this day, when Christian Scientists from around the world were rejoicing over and in their new edifice, another man was quietly contemplating what he saw as, quote, "marvelous beyond all imagining," end quote. Samuel Putnam Bancroft, who had been in a class Mrs. Eddy had taught in 1870, when she was still Mary B. Glover, had attended the dedication service and could not help but reminisce about the early days. The letter he wrote to Mrs. Eddy, Miscellany, page 58, on June 12th, was subsequently published in the Sentinel with the caption, quote, "A contrast of 40 years," end quote. Though Mr. Bancroft, whom Mrs. Eddy had affectionately called Putney in those early days, had not remained an active Christian Scientist, he had remained faithful, and he signed his letter, quote, "Respectfully and faithfully yours," end quote. The thing that most attracted public attention, aside from the building itself and the six services to accommodate the 30,000 who came to see it dedicated was the Wednesday evening testimony meetings. On this Wednesday evening, June 13th, meetings were held in a great many places. The first reader, William D. McCracken, presided over the largest gathering in the new extension. The new president of the Mother Church, William F. Gross, conducted an overflow meeting in the extension vestry. Another overflow meeting in the original Mother Church was conducted by second reader Laura C. Conant. The several additional overflow meetings in various other halls were conducted by Judge Hannah, Bicknell Young, Bliss Knapp, Edward A. Kimball, William P. McKenzie, Gilbert C. Carpenter, and Irving C. Tomlinson. The scientists were asked to name the place they lived before testifying, and as soon as the meetings were opened to the congregation, people jumped up to speak. People from Peoria, St. Louis, Berlin, Des Moines, Glasgow, Cuba, Brooklyn, Liverpool, Australia, California, London, Dublin, Paris, etc. The Boston Herald reported, quote, "No more cosmopolitan audience ever sat in Boston," end quote. The Herald report also stated, "To hear prosperous, contented men and women, people of substance and of standing, earnestly assure thousands of auditors that they had been cured of blindness, of consumption in its advanced stages, of heart disease, of cancer, that they had felt no pain when having broken bones set, that when wasted unto death, they had been made whole, constituted a severe tax upon frail human credulity, yet they were believed." If an attempt were made to give any account of the marvelous cures narrated at the meetings of the scientists, or wherever two or more of them are met together, it would be impossible to convey a conception of the fervor of belief with which each tells his or her experience. These are tales of people of standing and of substance, professional men, hard-headed, shrewd businessmen. Yet they all have the same stories of their conversion, either through a cure to themselves or to one near and dear to them. Evidently, a good many of the thousands of scientists who had come to Boston with such enthusiasm either had not read or disregarded the leader's notice, asking them not to come to Pleasant View. Lewis Strang wrote to Herman Herring, the first reader of the Concord Church, "If possible, she would like to have you seek out these thoughtless visitors and bid them spend the time that they are wasting in the worship of personality in careful study of the church manual, especially the bylaw, which positively forbids precisely the thing that they are doing. Mrs. Eddy desires that you say to them that Pleasant View is neither a watering place where they may spend their summer, nor a hospital where they can steal their healing." The following letter was written to Mrs. Eddy on June 26th, and she had it published in the Sentinel of July 7th. "Dear leader, being about to leave the States for South America to make my home in Ecuador for an indefinite season, I took the liberty of visiting Concord and driving out to your home some days since. I just wish to say that the lesson learned during that visit will not soon be forgotten. And I came away with a sense of having intruded upon your much desired, yea, needed seclusion. The significance of your words, quote, time to assimilate myself to God, end quote, came to me with renewed force. And I see how, under the guise of loving interest, we might become tedious hindrances to the fulfillment of not only your highest hope, but our own as well. Therefore, my next visit to Concord can only be upon special invitation from an authorized source. From the, quote, genial tropics, end quote, my love will go out to you as it ever has here, in joyous anticipation of future good news to tell you, I am earnestly yours, Mrs. Nina M. Henderson, Guayaquil, Ecuador. Mrs. Henderson's letter impelled, quote, personal contagion, miscellany, page 116, from the leader's pen, which she wrote to Mr. McClellan, is, quote, one of the most important things of thought I ever expressed, end quote. When published in the Sentinel, Mrs. Eddy's article preceded the letter from Mrs. Henderson and began, quote, the following letter is so right and requisite that I hereby endorse it for the readers, end quote. In her words to her editor regarding personal contagion, she also said, does it cost me no cross to write this? If you could look into my consciousness, you could see it does, even a human rebellion thereto. In the same issue of the Sentinel, July 7th, the leader published the letter written to her by James J. Rome, miscellany, page 60 to 62, telling about his night watching work for the church. She also wrote to the directors about Mr. Rome on July 2nd. Mr. Rome's article is rendering honor to whom honor is due in the great work that is just accomplished. I could not say it in my message and not comment on the officers in all the leading departments, and the message was too short for this, and to make it long enough, therefore, would have occupied in reading too much time for that great occasion of the dedication. Mr. Rome I know little of, but I like him, and he has now shown himself. Let us not forget him. In the summer of 1906, most Christian Scientists were in a state of euphoria, which put a greater burden on the leader, as her letter to John Lathrop at that time implies. Press on. You are in the line of light, thine to realize the glory of strife. Seeking is not sufficient whereby to enter the kingdom of harmony. I sorrow over the ease of Christian Scientists. They are not at ease in the pains of sense, but are at ease in its pleasures. Which drives out quickest the tenant you wish to get out of your house, the pleasant hours he enjoys in it, or its unpleasantness? I hope the teachers of Christian Science will awake to do their duty towards getting out tenants from ease and pleasure in substance and life in matter. I am worn with doing the work alone. The serpent of envy, which had used her promising young student, Richard Kennedy, to strike at the woman in 1871, had become the great red dragon of international proportions. An intricate plot had been laid to give extensive news coverage to lies and defamation of character, which had been planned to coincide with the completion of the Mother Church Extension in an effort to destroy the woman and her cause. But the woman had been warned of God and had insisted that the extension be completed a year earlier than planned. To mortal sense, this was an impossibility, and those who were accomplishing this impossibility kept a sacred silence. Even the field did not know the date of completion until it was publicly announced just a few weeks prior to dedication day. And within the next few weeks, the news coverage was extensive, fair, incredulous, full of praise and astonishment. Quote, "And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war." End quote. The woman needed the help of her students, now more than she ever had before, and they were all asleep, lulled by the wonderful praise and popularity. Even her darling Augusta, who was usually such a help to her, was somewhat nullified. The leader informed her of this change in her letter of July 3rd. "Do you in the least realize the change that has taken place in your kindness to me, in caring for my clothes? Mrs. Leonard charged you for me to have that silk made plainly. Instead, you had it made so I cannot wear it, and depended on it for my dress now. Therefore, need it to make me comfortable this season. I am working for you and all students continually, and so have no time to care for my wardrobe. Would not the world expect that the students who say they owe so much to their leader could do for me what I so much need, while I am doing thus for them? In haste, lovingly yours, ever your teacher and leader to heaven, health, immortality." This letter wakened Augusta to a degree from the general state of euphoria engulfing the field. In response to her answering letter, the leader wrote her again on July 7th. "My precious student, your dear letter of the 7th is just received. It comforts me. Now let me say that mental malpractice must be met daily by all the students, met by your mental protest that breaks the so-called law of a lie, or you are liable to be affected by this lie, all unconsciously. Dear one, remember this. Our master said, quote, had the good man of the house watched, his house would not have been broken open." End quote. "I am thankful for your reassurance of loving me, and pray God to enable me to do you good continually. Ever lovingly yours, Mary Baker Eddy." Note well, your kindness to me has been an example for others, and I shall not forget it, nor cease to speak of it as the great cause of your prosperity. But the glamour in the field, which none but the leader was aware of, was so pleasantly mesmeric that even her sturdy Augusta was greatly affected and only partially awakened, as Mrs. Eddy knew. So she wrote her, quote, "precious student," end quote, again the next day, July 8th. "I cannot see you glamored without an effort to save you. Remember what I have through God already done for you, and wake to a true sense of this, such as you used to have. Now, darling, I do not want you to attend to my clothes if it hinders your advancement in Christian Science. But you have told me that it did not, and proved it so. You have prospered in your growth and field of labor beyond other students, and I have seen that it was because you were so kind to me. If in any way I have wronged you, tell me of it, for I would not do it knowingly. I should feel better to pay you a salary that you will name for helping me, as you have done. Oh, my darling student, do not let this spell of malicious animal magnetism separate us. You have been strong on this point, and often said it never could do this. Rouse yourself to saying and realizing this now. Be strong. Tell me if you have anything to complain of me, and I will watch and pray that I do to you as I would be done by. The grave danger facing her church was that it would discard the leader, the discoverer and founder, for the praise, popularity, and prosperity of the world. If she could not awaken her Augusta from this enticing dream, there was little probability that she could waken anyone. The dear directors were asleep with the rest of the field. They knew that they had helped their leader to foil a demon scheme, and they thought that they had won the war. All in Boston were rejoicing in victory when they were alerted to another attack. In May, Alfred Farlow and Cornell Wilson had visited McClure's editorial offices in an unsuccessful endeavor to have an interview with S.S. McClure. Following the dedication, a keen writer from McClure's magazine questioned William Lyman Johnson at great length. Midst all the acclaim from other reporters, William Lyon sensed that this journalist was not friendly, and after consulting with his father, he wrote as much to Mrs. Eddy. But a letter of July 10th to John Willis from a student in Chicago, Mrs. Augusta B. Bensley, revealed the plot more fully. One of Mrs. Bensley's daughters was a freelance journalist in New York, and she had written to her mother. By the way, I have something of interest to say to you, which I think you will probably not be very pleased to hear. Mr. McClure, who is the owner and editor of McClure's magazine and of McClure Syndicates, has been here a good deal lately, and among other things, he has told me that McClure's magazine is going to start a crusade against Christian Science. They have been at this for some 2 or 3 years and have collected, as he put it, quote, a whole trunkful of documents, end quote, including many letters, some of them originals of Mrs. Eddy's, and some of them certified copies. And they have watched the whole course of things for some time with great care. They had people at the convention in Boston a few weeks ago, one of whom I know quite well. As far as I can find out, the first of these articles is to be published in January, and they are going on through a large part of the year. They are going to take up every phase of development of Christian Science and do what they can to ridicule and destroy it. This information is authentic. I had it from Mr. McClure's own lips. I do not know that there is anything that can be done by any of your people to stop it or interfere with his plans. But sometimes it is worthwhile knowing these things beforehand. Surely this letter helped to waken her lieutenants in Boston to the leader's words in Science and Health. Quote, "The serpent is perpetually close upon the heel of harmony. From the beginning to the end, the serpent pursues with hatred the spiritual idea. When nearing its doom, this evil increases and becomes the great red dragon, inflamed with war against spirituality." End quote. The leader's next step for spirituality was a bylaw amendment for her church, which had an implication none saw at that time. The change published in the Sentinel of July 14th read, "The general communion of this church shall be observed triennially in Boston Mass on the second Sunday in June." But because the leader had to take her followers one small step at a time, this amendment included a second sentence. "Its local communion service shall be held annually at the same date." Mary Godfrey Parker had known Asa Gilbert Eddy when she was a very small child and had been healed by Mrs. Glover before the latter became Mrs. Eddy. But she was totally uncomprehending when her husband announced one day, quote, "I shall never go to another communion. If we always have Christ with us, why go to communion?" End quote. But Danforth P.W. Parker was the exception rather than the rule. A happy note appeared in the last Sentinel in July. Under the caption, quote, "Prophecy by Longfellow," end quote, in this July 28th issue, was this note and poem. Quote, "The following interesting prophecy by the poet Longfellow appeared in the first number of the Atlantic Monthly." Editor, end quote. "Where'er a noble deed is wrought, where'er is spoken a noble thought, our heart in glad surprise to higher levels rise. Honor to those whose words and deeds thus help us in our daily needs, and by their overflow raise us from what is low. A lady with a lamp shall stand in the great history of our land, a noble type of good, heroic womanhood." When Mrs. Eddy read the July 28th Sentinel, she penned by the torch design on the right-hand side of the front cover, quote, "What if you put here the figure of a woman with a lamp in her hand? This would illustrate Longfellow's lines in verse. See page 763. End quote. On the left-hand side of the cover, she wrote, quote, "The same on this side," end quote. She also penciled the last four lines of Longfellow's poem on page 763 and sent this marked copy of the Sentinel to editor McClellan. 3 days later, on July 31st, Mrs. Eddy wrote McClellan again, "Beloved student, you will accept my thanks for your kind acceptance of my proposition for the Sentinel." This was the beginning of the new cover design for the Sentinel soon to appear.